Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
Well, I don't know if the court saves the best for last, what it means for me to go first, but it makes my dad living over in home and happy to know that I got to tell him I'm going first today. Your Honors, this is a case of utmost import. I don't need to go into all the details about how important it is, but I haven't been here in 25 years. Last time I was on a Longshore case, and I'm here on behalf of thousands of claimants that my firm represents, and indirectly hundreds of thousands of others impacted from the oil spill. The document I think that's most important in this case is the most recent one, which is the status report number 14, dated October 15 from Pat Juneau. It tells the tale of what's happened in this class. This court has a unique opportunity to not only guess as to what a class has with respect to typicality, commonality, fairness, it can actually go back and look at the history of what's actually happened, because this is a class that is actually funded and operated for the last 18 months. And what it tells us when we look at that track record is that there's some good. Part of this class is a good settlement. Some of my clients participated, and we supported that. The good is that it's paid billions of dollars in funds to needy people all up and down the coast. It's good that it paid 50,000 claims, but it's bad. And it's also good because it paid almost all the VU cases. It paid almost all of the coastal property claims. It paid almost all the vessel damage cases. 80-90% of those cases have been paid in this class. But it's bad because periodic vendors, only 8 of 300 have been paid. Only 25-30% of the business economic loss cases have been paid. Failed businesses, less than 2%. 38 of almost 3,000. Same for subsistence. So we can see that history. This settlement is good for some categories of cases. It's very bad for others. If it would have been broken down into multiple subset classes, maybe it would have been good for some of them to have been upheld. But it shouldn't in this case, because they're all stuck in the same deal. And it has to be fair to everyone. It's not just the amount of money that's paid. It's not just the amount of claims that get paid. It's the amount of claims that don't get paid. It's the amount of claims that should have been paid that didn't get paid. And that's before we get into all the other issues associated with the problems within the class, even for claims that get paid. It was represented that this claim settlement fund would be better than the GCCF. I have many clients, it's reflected in the documents others do too, that many people that participated in this, based on the representations of class counsel, that it would be fair to them, that it would treat them better than the GCCF, have been told, congratulations, you're eligible. We've looked at all your documents, and you don't get any money. That whatever your hardship payment was 2 years ago from the GCCF is more than we want to pay you now. And that's unfair. Those clients were duped into that process based on the notice and based on those representations.
It'd help me if you would relate your argument to the Rule 23.
Yes, well, it's clear from all that, Judge, that 23A isn't met. We don't, in our opinion, we don't have enough commonality of the claims. But more importantly, 23B. The predominance of individual damage issues in this case transcends every other issue. Under OPA, this is a strict liability case. BP assumes as a responsible party all liabilities. All these issues within the trial court, and Judge Barbier has done a fantastic job of welding the responsibility for all those issues. But this is a BP responsible party OPA case for all these claimants.
Okay, so, you have a red light, Mr.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Bacharach.
May it please the court, my name is Al Bacharach. I'm here for the Alpar appellants. And in answer to your question, the issue before this panel really comes down to commonality, or more precisely, the lack thereof. This class action settlement agreement cannot stand under our system of jurisprudence, because there is no commonality between people who are receiving benefits under the class action settlement. As we point out in the title to our argument, this class action settlement pays people whose injuries have no relationship whatsoever to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico that gives rise to this case. There is no requirement under this class action that someone making a claim with Mr. Juneau actually be able to show there's any causation between their injury and the oil spill.
Ms. Bacharach, you know, all of the parties here have mentioned in causation and the commonality, but no one has pointed out what language, either in Exhibit 4B or the settlement or these policy decisions, is in fact being used to cause payments to those people that have not been damaged by the oil spill, or excessive payments, except for BP.
Well, that's certainly strong evidence, Your Honor, but the evidence is that what the parties attempted to do and what the parties actually did is entirely different. What the parties intended to do was to lower the threshold of causation by letting damages substitute for causation, as if causation and damages were one and the same concept. And that's set out from the face of the document. The problem with doing that is that once you allow damages to substitute for causation, then there is no causation, because anyone who's damaged...
Anybody that can show damages, not who is damaged.
Anyone who can show damages during the correct time period. Because
is this limited only to Zone A?
No. It is not limited to Zone A.
There were a lot of common questions here. I mean, those issues that the judge severed out to try in the structured trial he set up, those are common to everybody. Everything doesn't have to be common.
Well, two responses to that, Judge Davis. One is the current Supreme Court trajectory with regard to class actions seems to be in the opposite direction of your belief. That is, the Supreme Court is moving it more and more in the direction that commonality means everybody's got claims in common, not that they have a general injury in common. And secondly, the problem here is not what the injured claimants have in common with each other with regard to damage from the oil spill. The problem with the settlement is the lack of injury caused by the oil spill that also allows people to be entitled to compensation under this class action settlement. So there's no commonality between a law firm whose senior partner dies in 2010 and they see a tremendous drop in revenue between 2009 and 2010 because the senior rainmaking partner is no longer with them, and someone whose business depends on the waters of the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, the oil spill affected hundreds of thousands of people because there are, in the Gulf Coast states, my state of Florida, Louisiana, people whose livelihoods depend on the ocean. But when people whose livelihoods have nothing to do with the ocean and whose livelihoods aren't affected by an oil spill can make a claim for millions of dollars, according to Mr. Olson's brief.
I've got red lights, sir. I mean, I'll take a reasonably long sentence, but it has to be reasonable.
Okay. I've been accused of that before, Your Honor. Right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Pence.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, John Pence on behalf of the Cobb appellants. If I could just take Judge Garza's question to Mr. Bacharach first. While there are many common issues here with regard to true class members, with regard to somebody who was not harmed by the BP oil spill, the question of whether BP has any liability for that spill is not a common question as to that business. It may be an academic question that they're interested in, but it doesn't affect any of their legal claims. I think this case is really more stark than it's been briefed to date, even by BP. We have a conflict here between the class definition, which does limit the class to people who were actually injured by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, yet we have a settlement agreement that clearly allows non-class members to make claims against the settlement fund because they sustained, not damages, Mr. Bacharach used the wrong term, they're not damages, they show a loss of some kind due to some reason. Mr. Bacharach suggested a named partner in a law firm could have died or retired. There are many examples that BP has provided.
Well, you also are arguing that every issue has to be common. You can't have issues that are not common.
No, absolutely not. No, only one issue has to be in common.
Well, we've got all kind of issues that the judge set up for trial.
But not with regard to strangers to the action who are now claiming and being paid through the settlement fund. Those people have no common issue with the true class, the people who were injured. And that's not something that can be waived, and it's not something that BP can contractually agree to. The argument here that they signed the settlement agreement, BP is constrained by the limits of Article 3 and the Rules Enabling Act, and they cannot agree contractually to permit a class settlement that includes non-class members. And I think
if we look at the definition of class, everybody is a class member.
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. Not everybody who's permitted to claim benefits through the settlement is a class member based on the class definition.
When I look at the complaint and I look at the settlement agreement, the definition in there, everybody that is here is a class member.
Yeah.
Well, you're right.
Mr. Pence, it's not necessarily a question of commonality, but whether there's
predominance.
It's a predominance issue that really is a problem here, which is AmCam and Comcast, it seems to me.
Well, you're correct, Your Honor. I mean, where commonality doesn't exist, then by definition, you don't have predominance. I mean, where there are no common issues, then common issues don't predominate. But
now there's a question here, because in Dukes has this interesting quote, and this is a quote, commonality requires that the plaintiff to demonstrate that the class member have suffered the same injury. This is 431 Supreme Court 2551. Now, is that the law now? Has to have the same injury?
Yes.
For commonality? And if it is, then we're really looking at the damages, causation, damages, injury side of this, not necessarily the liability side of which are many common, obviously common liability questions.
Right, correct. But you have to have an injury caused by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
Of course, you have to have causation.
And that's absent from the settlement mechanism from Exhibit 4B, which permits strangers, non-class members, to come in and claim funds when the class definition would not permit them to do so. There's a fundamental conflict between the settlement agreement and the class definition, and you cannot waive that objection. That can be raised at any time by anyone.
Thank you, Mr. Pence.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Frank.
May it please the Court, Theodore Frank for the Sturtevant appellants. The district court here committed multiple independent errors of law in its settlement approval that require reversal and at the very least remand. First of all, we have the predominance issue raised by this panel, and this court has already spoken on that in Steering Committee versus ExxonMobil. And there you had a much narrower set of liability issues that were very clearly common to the class, but the individualized issues predominated nevertheless. Even though it was a small locality, even though everybody was affected within the same 24-hour period.
And that was also an injury damage predominance.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the only way the district court got around that was relying on Watson versus Shell Oil, a case that, as this court said in Castano, is not precedential, is not have any real value.
You're saying that all damages have to be the same?
I'm saying that the damages issues have to have a commonality to them. So you could have subclasses here. I would imagine you could.
In that Madison case, we said you could try liability. So you could certify a class for that and go ahead and try your liability issue separately. I mean, your damage issue separately.
And I think Duke's precluded that now. We at the language they have at 2551, common questions or that matter are those that generate common answers apt to drive the resolution of the litigation.
Judge Davis brings an important question. This is not a class action where you're going to have a trial of liability. There is no liability. I mean, liability has already been admitted. Okay, so that's out of the question. Is there some type of difference in the law between those type of certifications that do that certify trials that will go when have liability and this type of a settlement where we really are talking about the causation damages, the injury causation and damage issues separately?
And I think that's exactly right. I think that's what distinguishes this case, this case from the washing machine cases that plaintiffs cite.
I mean, but don't you look at those issues that pre-exist the settlement in deciding that question? I mean, doesn't Amchem say that?
I think this also applies to – I think Amchem also helps us here because in Amchem you had the same issues relating to the production of asbestos, the general causation of asbestos injuries, but that wasn't enough to create the commonality or the predominance.
I mean, if you only look at the issues that existed after the settlement, you'd never have a settlement because it would undermine your class.
Before you get to that, though, you have the adequacy problem and you have the superiority problem, which we also noted. You have a case that's directly on point in Langbecker, 476 F3rd 299, again from this circuit. And there the class could not be certified, the representatives could not be held adequate because they sought an injunction that would eliminate a form of relief that some class members had and would prefer. And here, they didn't just seek that. They actually succeeded in eliminating the GCCF.
Mr.
Yes,
Frank,
Your Honor.
Can this thing be solved by having subclasses?
It can
those that can prove causation, and then this other group of claimants that... Or does this have to be sent back to decertified, and then sent back for a new settlement totally?
It needs to be you can't subclass it at this stage.
You got to
decertify it now and send it back for those subclasses. And then,
but do you agree that the subclassification would assist this class action to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, for some subclasses. I think there are other subclasses or subgroups that are uncertified and could not be certified.
One other question. There seems to be only one category, the business economic loss category, that's being disputed. Can we affirm the certification of all the eight other classifications?
Well, no, because there's only one single class, and that's the underlying problem.
But the articulation of those nine, I'm going to call them classes or subclasses. Nobody's talking about those. Just the BLE that's the problem.
Well, I am talking about all of those.
Okay.
But
it
was a single certification of a single class, and at this point you cannot carve out and create subclasses that never had the separate representation.
And that's because these like the Exhibit 4B applies to all of those classes.
Well, it's because the court certified a single omnibus class instead of subclassing it like it should.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Theodore Olson on behalf of BP. BP supports the settlement as properly construed and implemented to compensate claims for actual losses caused by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
As I understand it, as a baseline, you say that until those exhibits were introduced, this was a perfectly good settlement. There's no standing problem. There's no Article III problem.
We have supported the settlement, and
I mean,
we do support
right,
the settlement, and that is correct. Until the claims administrator, with the support of the district court, unmoored the settlement process from the specific terms of the agreement by reading causation and quantification of actual loss out of the settlement agreement. When that happened, all of those things disappeared. The requirements of Rule 23, concerns about standing, under the Rules Enabling Act and so forth, disappeared because was then a lack of commonality, a lack of typicality, a lack of predominance. All of those things disappeared. Now, if the agreement is properly resolved in the other process being supervised by the other panel of this court, in a way in which individuals who demonstrate that they were actually damaged by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill and they can demonstrate the actual extent of their losses under a process that was carefully developed and is being properly implemented, then BP is...
But didn't BP agree to a formula for deciding causation and measuring the loss? How can BP turn around now and say that Patrick Juneau caused it?
Well, what we respectfully submit that the other panel decided that the process had been distorted away from the actual specific terms, the commonly accepted accounting terms demonstrate, which were used to demonstrate the amount of the loss. Now, with respect to causation, which is integrally related to this, causation is in the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement talks about claims that are a result of the spill. Is in the definition of the class, there's reference to the same subject, actual claims that are caused by the spill. The claim forms that the claimants must file refer to the fact that they are claiming damages as a result of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. The district court approval referred to economic losses resulting from the spill. And the other panel referred on pages 4 to 5 to the class definition as individuals caused damage as a result of the spill. Now, in answer to your question, what BP agreed to is a process with respect to the demonstration of damages in various different categories that allowed the process to work, the claims administrator to do his job with the assistance of all kinds of accountants and other professionals to make sure that this was happening, that there was an actual legitimate claim based upon the oil spill that is calculated according to proper standards. Once that's done, then BP is comfortable with the settlement.
Mr. Right, but 4B and 4C was adopted by the interpretation set out in 4B and 4C was adopted with your agreement and had full opportunity to negotiate. I don't understand how you can now disagree with what's in there.
Well, in the first place, the other panel of this court.
I'm not talking about what the other panel did. I'm talking about what you did, what BP did.
Yes, what BP did is agree to, and it's been found by the other panel of this court, to specific commonly accepted terminology with respect to the calculation of actual damages. And when that was thrown away by the claims administrator and the district court, the terms of the settlement that were agreed to, as you say, by BP became something else. Black became white.
But you agreed to the exhibits also.
We agreed to those exhibits, but we agreed to the interpretation of those exhibits according to a commonly accepted provisions with respect to the calculation of revenue and expenses and the pairing of the revenue and expenses, the matching.
But maybe more important to this case, you agreed to the class that was certified.
Yes, a class that was certified, the class
based
that was...
Based on the pleadings of the parties.
Yes, and that class definition...
Why isn't that still good, if you thought it was good then?
It is good, but the definition is the class that was certified are individuals that suffered losses, actual losses, as a result of the oil spill. When you start including people that are not in that category.
Isn't that the end of the inquiry with regard to the certification?
It's.
We've been talking about that other case, but that has to do with the settlement agreement. This has to do with the certification
of a class that has injuries resulting from the oil spill. As soon as you include large numbers of people, and it's impossible to quantify it the way it's being articulated now, you create problems with respect to Rule 23, Article 3, which governs the construction of Rule 23.
On the face of the pleadings, you have no objection, as I understand it.
We have no
objection. Your basic objection is with the interpretation of the settlement agreement.
That's right.
Which is in another case.
That's right. And that's being supervised carefully by the other panel and Judge Barbier pursuant to the remand. That's being litigated over there. So questions of causation, questions of quantification of damages are being resolved by that pursuant to the instructions and of the that other panel and pursuant to its supervision because that court retained jurisdiction.
Mr. Holt,
I'm clear, didn't BP have an opportunity for several months to see how this claims administrator was interpreting that settlement agreement and particularly this cash basis and accrual basis? They saw exactly how he was doing it, and then after that, 4B and 4C were negotiated. I don't understand how you can come in after all that and say that you didn't know what was going on.
The record demonstrates, Your Honor, I respectfully submit, that BP objected to that process as soon as it became aware of facts that showed that it was being distorted. And that issue was considered by the other panel, and the other panel specifically said BP raised objections as soon as it could, as soon as it was aware of the problem. So BP didn't sit by and watch something happening and not object. It did object. And the problem is this court's responsibility under Rule 23 to interpret the provisions of Rule 23 properly. BP can't waive those provisions. It can't say, oh, we don't care. And as this court has held and the Supreme Court has held, simply the interest in buying peace does not solve the problem. Rule 23 is a part of the jurisprudence of this country, must be because the court then becomes an instrument in implementing a resolution.
But Mr. Olson, the problem I see, you can state it many ways, but what is the distinction that you're making between the case that was previously heard, which are the same arguments that you're making here, and this case where you're asserting that the class is not fair, not it's unreasonable and inadequate? The problem as I see it is that the interpretation of the settlement is an issue that's really not before us here. And that cuts almost all of your arguments that you've made in your brief. Now, what you have made an argument that the class should not be certified because it fails 23E. But I don't hear a distinction between the argument that you made in the prior, before the prior panel, and the argument that you're making here.
Well, I understand your question, Your Honor, and I think that's a legitimate question. Well, let me clarify that. We do believe that the resolution, if the settlement is properly interpreted and administered, does meet the requirements of Rule 23E, that it is a fair, reasonable, and adequate settlement, provided those issues are resolved. So the point that we're making here is not any different than what you just said. Those issues that BP has presumably are going to be resolved by the other panel with its retained jurisdiction over what's happening in
then
the district.
And if it doesn't go your way, you're going to be back up here again, not only on the interpretation, but on a decertification of the class.
It can't be certified, we submit. I think I'm agreeing with you. We're saying that if it isn't resolved so that those terms that are clearly in the agreement are implemented and carried out, yes, we will be back here. But if those, we're hoping and expecting that those, and because the evidence overwhelmingly supports the interpretation that we've offered to the district court and to the claims administrator and to the other panel of this court, that those issues will be resolved. And that may mean that this court will need to wait until those issues are resolved, because you will need to know what the interpretation of the settlement agreement is and is it being implemented in a manner consistent with that. And it can only be certified properly and the settlement approved if that is done.
Yeah. See, the nexus, your argument before this panel has a nexus that is identical to the rationale that was used with the other panel. It is one and the same. And I thought there was more to your argument from some of the briefs or some of the citations that you if that's not the case, that's not the case.
Let me see. I have a little different angle on that. I mean, it seems to me the focus here is on the interpretation of 4B and 4C, and Judge Southwick didn't join all of what Judge Clement said in her separate opinion. So I want to ask you, what's wrong with Judge Southwick's observation that 4B and 4C are simply agreements on evidentiary matters? How do you prove loss and how do you prove causation?
I think what Judge Southwick said is that because the issue wasn't specifically briefed and argued on that point before that panel, that he wasn't going to go as far as Judge Clement did, but he felt that it was the points that she was making were legitimate legal points. He called them logical. He thought that there was logic to them. He agreed that with the remand and a retention of jurisdiction by the panel to address those various issues. And, Your Honor, Judge Garza,
Let me then ask you, what is wrong with the observation? I think he made it, that 4B and 4C are simply matters of agreement on evidentiary matters.
Well, they are. I don't agree with, I respectfully don't feel that he said that. I think that he was in agreement with the fact that those provisions.
If I made the observation, would you agree or disagree with that?
I watch what you say.
What I would respectfully submit is that the process and exhibits 4B and 4C are part of a process that are intended to facilitate getting to the following resolution: payment of legitimate claims to people who are legitimately injured. And when the definitions that underlie the provisions in those two exhibits are changed so that they don't mean what they were intended to mean, and you have outcomes that are then paying people who are not actually damaged, paying people that were damaged or may have suffered some kind of a loss, but it's not related to the spill, you have a class that you can't possibly certify because it doesn't meet the requirements of Rule 23. And I think that's all that was involved in that other panel, and we're prepared to accept the resolution through that other panel because we presume that it will come out so that the people who suffer actual losses are being paid actual amounts that they deserve.
You know, the implication by some of the questions seems to be a major issue, and that is, does the agreement trump the requirements of Rule 23? And I think the answer is absolutely not. The court and this court still has an obligation to make absolutely sure that the agreement must comply with all the requisites of Rule 23. And that is, and see, that's what I thought you were making vis-a-vis your first argument in your brief that this is not fair, reasonable, and adequate.
Can I agree completely with everything that you've just said? We may not have expressed it very well because of the misunderstanding, I think, part of an import of your question. We do believe that under no circumstances may the agreement trump Rule 23. If the agreement is properly interpreted as it was intended in a manner consistent with the settlement agreement.
Let me make just two more questions because I'm making questions to you, but I want the other attorneys to listen up. Dukes seems to say that commonality requires the plaintiff to demonstrate that the class members have suffered the same injury. Now, by the same injury, does that mean that they have to have the injury that is caused by the spill as opposed to a injury that there is no linkage between the damage and the spill?
It must be an injury that is caused by the spill.
Okay. Now, secondly, and this is from Comcast, another quote. It says that a model purporting to serve as evidence of damages, you know, all these equations in this class action, must measure only the damages attributable to the plaintiff's theory of liability. Now, the question here is both under both theories of recovery, is that, do the agreements with all this lack of causation and all this other language that's in there, does it track the theory of liability?
We
the maritime law and the environmental law that's out there.
BP's position is that it does, unless the agreement is interpreted in a way to take causation or actual losses out of it. I think that you're absolutely correct the way you've quoted the Dukes case and the Amchem case with respect, which requires particularly careful scrutiny of a settlement agreement, and the Comcast case, which requires tying the theory of damage to the theory of liability. And that worked until the claims administrator took the liability and causation out of the equation.
Can this certification work if it's sent back? The district court creates a subclass, a class of those who have shown causation and those that have not shown causation. Or are you wed to the articulation of 4B, 4C?
Well,
according to what you,
if there's
economic
a,
principles,
if there's a class, or, that, if there's a class that can't show causation, of a subclass that can't show causation, that violates Rule 23. That cannot.
Isn't that what has been? I think one of the priors that damages has been substituted for causation. A showing of damages has been substituted for a concept of causation. Isn't that the if there's a problem, is that not the problem?
That is definitely a problem, because causation is a requirement in the definition of the class, in the notice to the class, and all of those things. The class notice is not valid anymore because it refers to damages caused by the spill. So to the extent that someone suffers an injury, and this court has addressed that in the MIMS case and in other cases, if someone has suffered an injury but it's not related to the liability of the defendant, that is not a proper Rule 23 class.
See, what I don't understand is why in any lawsuit or class action or whatever you have, the parties can't come in and stipulate and agree on what evidentiary basis it's going to take to prove up a claim. And I don't see where 4B and 4C does anything else.
Oh, well, I think that that's correct, except to the extent parties cannot agree to anything unless the requirements of Rule 23 are met, because then the parties can agree to any kind of settlement they want, but they're invoking the jurisdiction of the federal courts by Rule 23, and it affects the rights of people who are not parties. But the specific answer to your question, yes, parties can agree with respect to evidence, and they did agree with respect to evidence, and part of that evidence that they agreed to is based upon actual definitions of revenue and expenses and matching the revenue with the expenses so that actual damages are demonstrated. But each of that, all of that presumes a claim. Someone has to say under oath that their claim that they're submitting is related to the oil spill. That's a part of the claim form.
Petition and the settlement agreement defines the claimant just that way.
Yes. The causation, it's resulting from the spill, is a part of the settlement agreement. It's a part of the claim form that you have to sign under oath. It's a part of what the district court decides.
What we don't know is whether they can prove that.
Well, in most cases, they will be able to prove it. This is what the claims administrator is supposed to do, and they have all kinds of experts that are capable of looking into this, and evidentiary standards are what they are. When the claims administrator comes to a position where they know that the claim is based upon something that's unrelated to the spill, then the claims administrator has to do something about it, and I presume that will be addressed properly by the other panel.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Isaacroft.
Thank you, Your Honor. Samuel Zakharoff for the class. I think it's best to begin where Mr. Olson left off. The last case he referred to is Mims versus Stewart Title, the 2009 case of this court. And that case establishes two propositions that I think are central here. The first is, with regard to Article III standing, this whole business that this would be somehow outside the Constitution, the court said clearly that there are three elements to Article III standing, that there be an allegation of injury in fact, that there be an allegation of causation, and that there be an allegation of redressability. All of that is contained in the B-1 complaint. Every class member, by definition, alleges that he, she, it was injured as a result of the Deepwater Horizon spill, that this caused a decline in their revenues, their income during the relevant period, and that they want redress through the form of damages.
Mr. Secretary, let me ask you that, because I think that that's the gist of this lawsuit, it seems to me, this appeal. There's been numerous allegations from the objectors and even from BP that damages has, well, first of all, that the interpretation of the agreement has somehow been changed, that damages has been substituted for causation, that you have individuals that have suffered losses but not from the spill, or people that have suffered losses but have been given an excessive amount of damages. Okay, those are the arguments, it seems to me. Now, from your perspective, what is your argument that we do not have that in this particular case?
Your Honor, if we go to MIMS, the second part of the opinion in that case concerns the certification, the upholding of a certification of a litigation class on state law claims, and the court said, and I quote, "The district court was not required to determine that every class member suffered damage as a prerequisite to class certification." In the litigation context, this court, on a couple of occasions, for example, most notably in the securities context, has required proof of damages, loss causation, as a prerequisite to class certification. In its most recent manifestation in the Halliburton Erica John Fund case, the court was reversed unanimously by the Supreme Court on that point. So what we have is a standard in this court and in the Supreme Court that proof of damages is not a prerequisite to the certification of a litigation class.
Now, let's poke at that a little bit. Now, Dukes seems, again, I'm going to go back to those two quotes, because it seems to me we got to flesh out this tension here.
Right.
And that is that commonality requires the plaintiffs to demonstrate that the class members have suffered the same injury. Now, can there be the same injury if there is no causation requirement in the settlement, as interpreted right now?
Well, I think that this court in MD versus Perry interpreted Dukes for operational purposes in this circuit. And what the court said was those quotes from Dukes stand for the inquiry on under 23A2 commonality as to whether the joint prosecution of the case would resolve issues that are central across the board. And let me read what this court has said. The commonality test is no longer met when the proposed class merely establishes that there's at least one issue whose resolution will affect a significant part of the class. That's the prior standard. And then this court, and Judge Garza, I'm quoting from you, this court says, and so you know this quite well, rather Rule 23A2 requires that all of the class members' claims depend on a common issue of law or fact whose resolution, and this is the quote from Dukes that this court has operationalized, will resolve an issue that is central to the validity of each one of the class members' claims in one stroke.
But well, just a minute. But Dukes, the actual words from Dukes, and this is what bothers me about this, the actual wording from Dukes, have suffered the same injury.
Yes, they have suffered the same injury. They've all lost their livelihood or their business revenue as a result of the economic calamity that followed from the Deepwater Horizon spill. That's the allegation. That's what this case was organized about. And this is not an abstract question, Your Honor. In August 2011, there were comprehensive motions to dismiss filed before the district court, including one by Cameron that said there can be no liability under the Oil Pollution Act, OPA, under any of the theories asserted by the plaintiffs. The case was organized among the survivors of the motion to dismiss. Some of the claims were dismissed as a result. But the claims that survived were the basis of the class certification going forward and formed the basis of the definition of the class in this particular case. So there is a commonality in the sense that all these class members have survived a motion to dismiss on the viability of their claims under OPA. And unlike every other case that we deal with in normal class action, this is not an abstract question of whether these common issues predominate and whether they are capable of common resolution. This is a case that's organized under the admiralty principles that have other mechanisms of joinder, which are not exactly like Rule 23, but operate functionally quite like Rule 23. So we've already had a limitation trial here, where all these questions that are common to all class members are indeed being resolved at one stroke, and that includes the extent of culpable conduct, it includes the extent of the harm. And with regard to Transocean and Halliburton, who have not settled, these class members, 100,000 plus of them, are members of the limitation action who are collectively prosecuting their claims to this day against Transocean and Halliburton.
Mr. Secretary, let's go to the next quote, the Comcast, and that is, quoting, a model purporting to serve as evidence of damages in this class action must measure only those damages attributable to the plaintiff's theory of liability. Now, both OPA and maritime law require causation. How do you get around that if in these exhibits, you have concepts that are substituted for causation, that you have no functional equivalent in either OPA or maritime law?
I do not believe that they are substitutes for causation. I agree fully with Judge Davis's formulation that these are evidence of causation, which is used in the settlement to define who is in and who is out. The problem in Comcast, the reason that the plaintiffs could not maintain the class certification in Comcast, was that they had no proof as to how the class felt an impact on a collective basis, because three of the four subgroups of that class, there was no evidence whatsoever that there was any relation between what had happened in their zone, their geographic zone, and the behavior of the defendants.
So what you're saying is that if there was an individual case, somebody opted out, we had an individual case, that individual, both under OPA and maritime law, could substitute as a matter of evidence damages for causation. Is that what you're saying?
I am not saying that. I'm saying that if an individual went to trial, the individual would have to establish what happened on the Deepwater Horizon, what the responsibility of the relevant parties were, how much oil was spilled, what level of culpability, were there punitive damages available, all these sorts of things, which are the common issues at the core of the liability. Then they would have to show how, by evidence, how that affected them, the specific causation. What the parties have done here, as they do in every class action settlement, is they have developed a formula that establishes the specific causation as to the individuals. The general causation that there was a downturn in the Gulf economy as a result of BP is a common issue, and the extent of that harm is still being litigated to this day. We've only had two of the scheduled four phases of the trial on these issues. This is, I would submit, Judge Garza, that this is an extraordinary situation where this court has never, never overturned a settlement class in conditions where the right to opt out was maintained and where there were not personal injuries that would make everything so wildly disparate as to the individuals that they could not be effectively corralled into one proceeding. Never.
And I agree with everything you say, and this is, my thanks to all the attorneys and everyone that's participated in this class action. My only concern is with Comcast, Dukes, and MCAN, and whether or not this settlement, which is laudable, comes within the requirements of Rule 23, and that to me is a major problem.
That's not what we talk about Comcast. I mean, I read that as an antitrust case, and the court was getting at the point that you can't, in an antitrust case, you can't have a liability and damage theories that are incompatible.
That's exactly how I read it, Your Honor. And here, the liability theory is quite separate from the damages theory. The liability theory is you shouldn't pour millions or billions of gallons of crude into the Gulf of Mexico.
Wait a minute.
That's the liability
theory. The liability theory is that you, excuse me, you're a lawyer. The liability theory is there's been a violation of maritime law and OPA.
That's
correct.
That's
the theory.
That's
and,
correct.
And if this is going to be a legal case and not an equitable case, then we got to look at the law, the substantive law, and the procedural law, it seems to me.
That's right. And if one looks at OPA, what OPA makes clear is that it is more expansive than traditional maritime law. The district court, in a what I think is the leading opinion on the extent of OPA liability, which has not been extensively litigated and there's not much dispositive case law, the district court said that after the arguments of the parties, it had concluded that the extent of liability under OPA is somewhere between a but-for and approximate cause standard. I think that that's an entirely defensible ruling. No party took that up. That's the law of the case. Assuming that expansiveness, what OPA also has is it relaxes the proximate damage, the sort of Robbins dry dock direct impact requirement, so that there's now the possibility of recovery, not just of those who were touched by the oil, but all the way up whoever was affected by the oil under this intermediate standard between but-for and proximate cause. And once we move up there, we see that even BP, under the GCCF, its predecessor, paid claims throughout the state of Mississippi, paid claims throughout the state of Alabama or Louisiana, and they paid them because they recognized under the administration, their private administration through Mr. Feinberg, they recognized that there was liability under OPA for all, or potential liability for all these claims.
Let me ask you one thing about standing. What's your position about where do you look to see whether the necessary facts and elements have been alleged to show standing? Do you look beyond the complaint and the settlement agreement and a settlement class? I mean, what do you do with the language in the Walmart case where it says you've got to make a constant inquiry about that?
Well, I think that Walmart does not affect this court's ruling in MIMS, that the standing question, there's several different standing questions. One standing question is the Article III standing question, and for that, the law has always been consistent. You look at the face of the instrument. It's the well-pleaded complaint rule has been the definition of Article III standing for over a century. Then the question is the standing to object, which we did not address, but the Supreme Court in Devlin versus Scardelletti says that you only have standing to object that which affects you. So when Mr. Frank gets up here and says, I'm objecting across the board, he has four clients. And we don't believe they're even class members, but assuming that they're class members, those four clients are asserting only a coastal claim. So they don't have standing under the Supreme Court case of Devlin versus Scardelletti to raise anything beyond that. There are no individuals here who are coming before the court complaining about the BEL. Mr. Olson objects, but Mr. Olson did not take an appeal from the December 21 order. He's not a proper appellant in this proceeding. There is no appellant in this proceeding who asserted that the BEL compensation was improper. So that's a second order of standing. Now then Your Honor asked about Dukes. I would submit that Dukes is not a standing case. Dukes is a question about class certification and about the commonality element. And the commonality element is a pragmatic consideration as to whether this really looks like one collective case. And the operational language from Dukes is relying on my late colleague Richard Nagareda's work, can you get common answers here? Not across the board, not all common answers, but will we generate meaningful common answers that advance the resolution of this litigation at one stroke? And again, I'm quoting the language from Walmart.
I would agree with that with regards to a class certification for trial. How about for the settlement? Is there a distinction there? In other words, the live issues that are left are really damage, causation, damage, and remedy.
Well, but that's, in one sense, that's always true in a settlement. In a settlement, you take the liability off the question because the parties have settled. And
well, that's, you know, there's beaucoup Supreme Court decision that these mass torts are not the type of tort that should be within Rule 23. And I agree with what you're saying. That's a problem.
As but this court said in steering committee, Your Honor, the reason that the mass torts are usually not amenable to this kind of class treatment is because they can't be managed at trial. So now we have the one critical difference between trial and settlement that the Supreme Court acknowledged in Amchem, which is that there's no manageability concern. But even in steering committee, this court did not impose a bright line rule saying you could never have a mass tort. All that the court said was you can have mass harm cases if you can show how they will be tried. And I would submit to you that this is not the mass tort that you usually have in mind when you talk about how mass torts are not amenable to class treatment. This is not a personal injury case. This is not the idiosyncratic harms. This is not like Katrina or like Madison versus Chalmette. This is not a case where you have all sorts of different kinds of injuries. And I would, Judge Garza, I would suggest that this court, on a couple of occasions, has looked to whether there is a logical internal organization to the claims such that it would be proper to have class certification, even if there's variation. For example, this court's decision last year in Rodriguez, in which two of the members of this court were on the panel, the fact that this was already aggregated through bankruptcy gave the court a lot of comfort in saying that this should go forward as a class action. And I would submit that the admiralty connection here is critical, because what Judge Barbier did was he married the Rule 23 requirements to the way this case was organized collectively under admiralty joinder procedures.
Comment. Let me ask you a question about the admiralty case. Sturdivant argues that we don't have adequate representation because we don't have a representative who had physical damage to property so that they could get around Robin's dry dock. What's your answer to that?
Well, this court in most recently in M.D. Perry drew a distinction between the factual findings of the district court, which are subject to all the deference in the world, and the legal claims, which are subject to de novo review. The claim made by Mr. Frank was expressly rejected as a fact finding by the district court. The district court found that there was a representative of every distinct subgroup that was involved here. The district court found that the representation was adequacy because the plaintiff's steering committee had been drawn from lawyers who represented all the affected constituencies. And the facts of this case, when you get down into the guts of it, one of my co-counsel has a client who's a member of five, who has five different types of claims. He's a shrimper, he has some land, he has a vessel that was damaged. You can't have subclasses. Subclasses are about people with different kinds of interests. This is a community which works across many different occupations, and so the class action is organized the way that they are. Now, Mr. Frank raises that, Mr. Sturdivant raises that, and then it turns out they're not even on the water in their personal property. But even assuming that we get past that, what is their claim? Their claim is that this shows that there was a superior mechanism under the GCCF. Those claims were not compensable under the GCCF. These are individuals who have never filed a claim who come forward and say, we would be better off under a system that doesn't exist any longer, under which we would have gotten nothing, and in exchange we want to take away the claims of the Vessel of Opportunity folks, the claims of all the seafood claimants, who are not here. Nobody. There's nobody here representing those individuals saying this is a bad deal for us.
What's your best case for the proposition that all class members do not have to have a colorable claim, or is that your position?
That is not our position. That is the law of this circuit. However, we do not run away from the colorability point. Okay. In fact, I would refer the court to BP's memorandum in support of the approval of the settlement, where referring to the testing of the claims that had gone on prior to the settlement, BP says, and I quote, "The class definition takes pains to exclude claims that BP does not believe are even colorably compensable under OPA or maritime law." If I can just finish this point, Your Honor. Judge Clement, when she raised this issue, was quoting Judge Jordan. Judge Jordan was worried about a situation where there are antitrust claimants who are forbidden by law from recovering. So they're not colorable because they're in Illinois BRIC non-repealer states and they're indirect purchasers. There's nobody here who is forbidden by law from recovering. It's a factual question. And in all settlements, you have to give the district court the ability to weigh the facts to see if they are plausible claims. And the district court has done that in a variety of guises here, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Oshkoff. Okay, we're back to Mr. Bacharach.
Judge Garza, damages just don't equal causation. I was the one that said it. I stick by it. Duke says there has to be some injury. That's causation. When Professor Isakharov is explaining this to the panel, he confuses injury with damages in his explanation. Duty, proximate causation, and damages. We're not talking about duty and breach of duty. We're talking about damages here. Damage is substitute for causation. You cannot have a class. Judge Davis, it's true. The parties can normally agree to anything they want, as long as a contract doesn't violate criminal statutes. You can enter into a contract to settle almost any matter. But that's not true in a Rule 23 or in a class action context, because in a class action context, all those unnamed parties are not signing off on the agreement. So you can't agree to anything you want. You have to agree to something that fits within the Rule 23 structure.
The minutes are pretty short time, Mr. Bacharach. You have a red light.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, and now Mr. Frank.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me cut through the Gordian knot, because there's a Second Circuit case that's directly on point that we cite in our briefs, and that's In Re Literary Works, 654 F3rd 242. And that's a B3 class action against Google that was much simpler than this one, because there are only three categories of damage. And what the Second Circuit did there, they didn't reach the issue of commonality, they didn't reach the issue of predominance, but they threw out the settlement entirely because there was not proper subclassing, there was not proper separate representation. Even though there was no factual finding that any of the three subgroups might have been treated unfairly, and even though the Second Circuit did not dispute that it was appropriate to have different damages formulas for the different subgroups, it was improper to put them all in one omnibus class with one set of representatives and one set of class counsel.
Does this settlement is uncapped solve most of those problems?
No, Your Honor, because at the end of the day, BP is working to settle an omnibus litigation. They know that attorney's fees are coming. And as this court held in Strong, it all comes from the same pocket. They know what, if you structure the settlement a certain way, if you pay eight times as much to the shrimpers and two times as much to the economic loss damages, it's going to add up to a certain amount, and they knew they were working from that pot of money.
But, I mean, you got to show also the district court was clearly erroneous in refusing to do these subclasses. I mean,
no, Your Honor.
What evidence do you have, or what's your argument that he was clearly erroneous?
My argument is that he applied the wrong standard of law. The question is separate representation. It's not that there was representatives and somebody handpicked by class counsel after class counsel was picked was supposedly an adequate class representative. They have to be separately represented with separate class counsel. And it was the same issue in Amchem, because there was no showing there that the latent class members were unfairly treated and that there wouldn't be enough money in the fund to eventually pay them. The same thing happened in Dewey versus Volkswagen because, again, there was no dispute that the unrepresented subclass and uncertified subclass would eventually get compensated.
I wanted to ask you specifically about your maritime claim. Do you say that there's no representative here who has a claim based on physical damage to property, a maritime claim?
The problem is that the settlement structures it with differently for different states. So Louisiana gets this huge bonus that Texas and the other Gulf states don't get. And there wasn't a separate representation with respect to that sub-differentiation. But I think that just falls short. I think that backs up to Mr. Sakharov says that there is only one type of damage here. You can look at page 35 of his brief, and there's this big skyline of different types of damages and different types of class members being treated differently, some being treated better than the GCCF and some being treated worse.
Why would we compare this to GCCF? I mean, I thought what we compared it to was whether it was more advantageous to try these claims separately as opposed to in a class.
No, because the superiority inquiry under B3 has to look at all possible other resolutions, and that's what this court said in Castano, and Vinsler versus Toyota directly refused to certify a class because of the availability of extrajudicial settlement processes.
Of course, the judge made some pretty powerful findings on why the claims administration that he chose was advantageous. I didn't see really any holes poked in those reasons.
I would disagree with that. It's the same claims representatives, and you can poke a hole in it by the fact that we have this whole separate BEL litigation, and you have very sophisticated lawyers and very sophisticated judges who cannot agree what the settlement means. How can lay class members agree to that, and how can they have had adequate notice to know whether or not to opt out, when even as we sit here today, we don't know what the settlement provides?
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank counsel for all their arguments. Very helpful. We have your case.